ESPN College Football Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the ESPN College Football Podcast for February 9th. I'm Adam Rittenberg. Thrilled to be back hosting the show after joining last week with Matt Schick and Tom Van Haren to talk recruiting and Michigan. And there's just no shortage of news in college football, even though we're still in early February. We'll visit later in the show with Chris Lowe from ESPN.com, senior writer, about the ever-developing situation at Auburn involving head coach Brian Harsin. But right now, I'm really excited to talk to one of my new colleagues at ESPN about the period that I love, which is between the end of the college football season and the NFL draft. We get to see all of these players that all I know college football fans are familiar with getting ready for that next phase, that phase that they've been working their entire career for, and that's to be professionals. And Jordan Reed is here to break down the Senior Bowl and the Shrine Game and the latest draft projections as we get ready for the next major draft event, pre-draft event, I should say, and that is the NFL Combine. So, Jordan, thanks for joining us here on the College Football Podcast.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you obviously were in Mobile. I know you've been traveling a lot the last few weeks, but specifically with that event, who stood out to you the most at the top of the draft, guys that are, you know, trying to move up in the first round? And then who improved their stock most that was maybe a mid-round guy or someone who was not as much on the radar of the general managers and the coaches and the personnel folks who took that step that they needed to? That's, I always love those stories, and they happen every year at that event in Mobile, that guys go from pretty much unknown to everyone's talking about them.
Yeah, and I mean, we all know everybody wants to hear about the quarterbacks. That's what everybody wants, and it's the most important position in sports. So the big emphasis for the Senior Bowl this year was the quarterbacks, and I think this group was the most fascinating since what we saw in 2018 when Josh Allen and Baker Mayfield went down to Mobile, Alabama, and had a really good week of practice. But I think what is so different about this quarterback class is that the past 3 years is that we've seen the quarterback one really jump out and gravitate towards being that number one overall pick, whether it was Kyler Murray in 2019 or Joe Burrow in 2020, and even last year with Trevor Lawrence. We've always had that presumed quarterback one at the top, but it's just not like that this year. But we had five of the top six projected quarterbacks at the top of the draft actually in Mobile. So we were going to see each and every one of these guys side by side outside of Matt Corral, who obviously didn't graduate on time to be eligible for the Senior Bowl. But outside of that, we have Malik Willis and Kenny Pickett, also Desmond Ridder and Carson Strong, and then also Sam Howell, who was able to graduate from North Carolina a year early. And it was good to see him go down and compete. So I think all of those guys helped themselves for the most part. I think Malik Willis probably stood out the most of the bunch, and then after that, it probably would be Kenny Pickett, which is probably the two guys that you're going to see the most at the top of mock drafts. But we don't know. There's 32 different teams, and we know there's going to be 32 different orders as far as the quarterback needy team. So the quarterbacks are the people that everybody wants to hear about, but I think Malik Willis and Kenny Pickett are the two that really helped themselves the most. And one player that really was off the radar that really helped himself a lot was Christian Watson. He's a wide receiver from North Dakota State. I thought he was a player that was a little bit banged up coming into the season, and he battled a hamstring injury, and he wasn't even healthy in the national title game when they ended up winning it. But he looked the part, and that's what you worry about with these small school players, is that how are they going to adjust to the game speed, and just when is the light going to turn on for them, just because they're going against these players in the ACC and the SEC, and the speed at the in Mobile is a little bit different than what they see throughout their career. So Christian Watson from North Dakota State, who's a wide receiver, helped himself a ton.
You went through the quarterback group, and it's an interesting one, and one that college football fans certainly know about, but it's not that group of three or four that are no doubt top 10 picks. This year's draft is maybe more about the linemen, and we'll get to that. But from your perspective as someone who dives into this and covers the draft process so closely, is it more interesting, a draft like this, or one where you have three or four quarterbacks that are already being labeled as franchise guys?
Yeah, it makes it fun for sure. And this group is very similar to the 2018 class. And if you guys remember, nobody knew that Baker Mayfield was going to be the number one overall pick up until about 5 minutes before they turned the pick in. So I think that's what makes this group so fascinating. I don't think we're going to see a quarterback go number one overall just because Jacksonville already has their guy in Trevor Lawrence. But after that, it becomes really interesting. You can see the Carolina Panthers at 6 taking a quarterback, the Washington Commanders at 11 taking the quarterback, and then also the Denver Broncos with the number 9 overall pick too. So there's so many different spots in that top 12 to 15 range of where these guys could go. But without there being that consensus number 1 player, number 1 guy at the position, we don't know where the first one is going to be taken.
Yeah, that number 1 overall pick is fascinating this year. It certainly could take shape in the next few weeks, where we know who it will be when that name is called in late April. But in your mock draft, Jordan, you have Evan Neal, the outstanding offensive lineman from Alabama, who's played guard, he's played tackle, most notably at tackle for Nick Saban and the Crimson Tide, going number 1. But then our colleague Todd McShay has a different player. He's got Aiden Hutchinson from Michigan, the defensive end, who's been atop some of the draft boards. Also seen Kayvon Thibodeau's name there, and he's the guy I want you to ask you about, because Kayvon Thibodeau's all over the map. You know, you've got him pretty high. McShay's got him, I think, at number 7, which is you know, lower than I've seen him projected in probably a year. What is the buzz about Kayvon Thibodeau? Because physically, he obviously looks the part. He was regarded very well in the Oregon program. Why is his projection a little bit scattered, I guess, to say at this point, where he's not a no doubt top 2 pick?
Well, a lot of times what happens with defensive players at the top of the draft, when they don't really, I wouldn't say, I think he firmly lived up to the hype this year, but he was a little bit banged up. He didn't have the season like an Aiden Hutchinson or a David Ajabo had, which was really expected of him, but he really was very productive this year. And I think with Thibodeau, with Hutchinson and Ajabo having the seasons that they did have, it kind of clouds him a little bit, but I still think the world of him. I think he's the best defensive player in this draft overall, not just the best player at the position, but I think it just comes down to what you want between those players. I think Hutchinson is a little bit further along as far as his production and his potential. Right now, he's a little bit more polished. And then with Kayvon, he's just learning what I like to call how to out-athlete people. Right now, that's really what his game is predicated upon. But I thought he took steps the past 2 years of putting a plan together, showing some maturation as being a true defensive end and stringing moves together. So it just comes down to, do you want to bet on the polish versus potential with either one of those players? But I still think Kayvon will be the first defensive player drafted. That's just my hunch. But the great thing about the draft with McShay, Kuiper, and then myself is that we all talk to similar people, but we talk to different people as well. So he may be hearing something different than I am, and that's why the rankings can fluctuate a little bit.
Yeah, Jordan, you have Kayvon going number 2 overall. But what's interesting about your mock is that all 5 of the first picks go into Jacksonville, Detroit, Houston, the Jets, and the Giants are all linemen. In your mind, where is that storyline as we get ready for the draft? Just the strength of the line positions, whether it's offensive line or defensive line, is it really only there at the top? Or does that persist really throughout the depth of the draft as you assess it?
It's actually throughout the draft. I think offensive tackle and defensive end are two of the more prominent or strengths of this draft class, which is something we haven't seen in years past. I know the offensive tackle classes have been very strong the past few years, but defensive end hasn't necessarily been good or jumped out to you since we've had Myles Garrett or the Bosa brothers or players along that nature. And even Chase Young when he was coming out a few years ago. So you had guys at the top, but the depth wasn't great throughout. But I think with this class, through day 2, I think you have a lot of depth along the offensive line and then also the defensive lines as well, which is what we saw in Mobile, Alabama. The defensive lines were just dominant through 3 days of practice.
Well, one area that I always love to discuss is the defensive back spot, because there's varied projections, and that's the exciting thing. You just talked about how you and Todd McShay and Mel Kiper all have different sources, some of the same sources, but you're getting some different perspectives on players. And one that I that jumped out to me, just your projection versus Todd's, is a guy from Cincinnati, and that's Sauce Gardner. And anyone who watched Cincinnati and their signature defense under Luke Fickell knew the name Sauce Gardner and what he did as an outstanding cornerback for that Bearcats team that went to the college football playoff and made history as the first group of 5 team to get in there. Todd has him at 5. Your projections, Jordan, you got him all the way down at 16. Why the disparity in your mind? And what does a guy like Sauce Gardner, who really accomplished about all you can at the college level, what does he maybe still need to do to move up the draft boards and ideally get into the top 10 with a Derek Stingley, with a Kyle Hamilton, who are seemingly more firmly in that top 10?
I think with mock drafts, it really just comes down to fit and then also need. So you can't necessarily just go based off where I have them in the mock draft. That's not to say you were doing that or anything, but a lot of times it just depends on scheme and then fit. But I actually got a chance to see Sauce Gardner play live when they came to East Carolina, which I'm based in North Carolina right now. So I wanted to get over to see him, Desmond Ridder, and then also Myjai Sanders. And he was the best player that I saw live this year, and I saw quite a few players this year. I mean, he's every bit of 6'2.5". He's probably around 190 to 195 pounds. And I put this in the mock draft at the bottom. It wouldn't surprise me if he ends up being the first cornerback off of the board, just based off the production that we have seen from him. And he's put it on tape over the past 3 years, as opposed to a Derek Stingley, who had the phenomenal year in 2019, but he's been banged up over the past two. So I don't think it's necessarily a situation of where I have him in the mock draft. I still could springboard Sauce over Derek Stingley based on I want to see what he runs at the combine too. I think that's a big question mark out there about him too, just his straight line speed. But as far as the game and what he's put on tape, he's done everything that he needs to do to be the first cornerback off of the board.
You know, another defensive back I wanted to ask you about, Jordan, is someone you highlighted in your Senior Bowl recap, and that's Jalen Petrie of Baylor. You know, another name very familiar to college football fans, certainly Big 12 fans, and certainly Baylor fans, as that defense propelled them to a Big 12 championship this year. I'm curious what you saw out of him in Mobile, and maybe overall the Big 12 players, because it jumped out to me that more than half of their contingent in Mobile at the Senior Bowl were defensive guys. And that was a league that really pivoted from being quarterback and video game offense and high scoring to more of the complementary football. You saw Oklahoma State, top five defense. Baylor was a top 10 defense. And now that seemingly is translating to the NFL, but I'm curious what you're hearing about a guy like Petrie, but also how the NFL folks are viewing the Big 12 on the defensive side.
Yeah, outside of Perrion Winfrey, the defensive player, and Jermaine Johnson, I should say, from Florida State, the defensive player that impressed me the most was Petrie. I was blown away by him. And he's one player I spotlighted coming into the event just because in Dave Aranda's defense, they have that most notably named what's called the star position, which is what Minkah Fitzpatrick played in Saban's defense. And there's been some other notable first round picks that have went on to play that position too in Saban's defense. But Aranda runs some very similar schemes. And we know that Baylor defense was outstanding last year. That was one of the biggest reasons of their turnaround. But I just love Petrie's makeup. And if you remember, he was in Matt Rhule's very first recruiting class. And then that very next year, they went like 1-11, I believe it was, his first year at Baylor. And then he's been through so much turmoil. He's been through so many other things. And that he's really seen the sunshine of everything, so to speak. And we know how special Baylor was last year and the turnaround that Coach Aranda has been able to do. But a big reason for that was Jalen Petrie. And the way that they used him, he kind of was the low safety in that he makes a bunch of tackles around the box and around the line of scrimmage. So a big question mark for him coming to the event was just how well he played in coverage, just because we didn't see a whole bunch of it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's a deficiency or a negative for him. He just wasn't able to do that. He wasn't able to showcase that and around his defense just because of the requirements that they had him doing. But he was outstanding in coverage. He's a loose mover. He probably was around 5'11", hovered around 200 pounds. And, you know, there's a lot of comparisons that were made for him. You know, Tyrann Mathieu was one that was out there for him, just talking about the role that he was playing for Baylor, not necessarily the player that he's going to turn into, but just how comfortable he was in coverage, how loose of a mover he was, and then how great his ball skills were too. So I was blown away by Petrie.
Just sticking with the defensive side, Jordan, you know, the defense helped Georgia to its first national championship in my lifetime, and I think in your lifetime. And there's so many outstanding players on that side of the ball that seemingly project well to the NFL level. Obviously, N'Kobe Dean's a likely top 10 pick and so forth. But I'm curious what you saw out of a guy like Devontae Wyatt in Mobile, and just overall where you see that group of players on defense for Georgia, where they get drafted, and how you think they'll turn out as pros.
It's kind of like you could play any, meeny, miny, mo with one of those guys, just projecting them to the next level. And Devontae Wyatt was great at the Senior Bowl. Jordan Davis, we saw what he was able to produce this year and the accolades that he took home. He probably was one of the more important pieces or a glue guy of that Georgia defense that just allowed everybody to roam and play free. We know what N'Kobe Dean was able to do. Jalen Carter is probably a top 10 guy that we'll be talking about a lot in 2023 next year, who's an interior defensive lineman. But one player that you're probably going to hear about is Trayvon Walker, who was a defensive end there. A lot of people are really excited to see him at the combine. He's probably I think he's probably going to run in the 4.6s or the 4.7s, which would be phenomenal at 6'5", 270 pounds. So it's a situation of where you just pick and choose whoever you want from that front seven. There's plenty of other players that a lot of people are excited about. I know one of my favorites is Lewis Seen, who's a safety who was outstanding in the national championship game. So then also Darion Kendrick, who came over after having some hiccups at Clemson, and he reshaped his image too. So there's a lot of different players that you can really get excited about from this Georgia defense.
Yeah, Seen was the most outstanding player on defense for that national championship win. Jordan, you mentioned the combine, and that's the next big event here. Who are you most excited to see there in Indianapolis, and who maybe needs to have a strong performance there to help their stock or answer some lingering questions that you're hearing from NFL people, maybe not sold on them as a first rounder, or hey, they could take a big jump if they have a really good combine?
So I'm one that always likes the on-field drills as opposed to testing, just because that shows you how guys move around. So I'm looking forward to seeing Derek Stingley back in action. It feels like forever since we've seen him move around. He can kind of quiet some question marks that are out there about him with the durability issues and then just how healthy he is. Of course, we already talked about Sauce Gardner and how fast he's going to run, but George Karlaftis is one player that a lot of people are looking forward to seeing too, just because you're going to hear some question marks about his athleticism, how well he bends and all of these things. I think he'll test fine, but of course, with the evaluations, you just want to see it on paper.
Yeah, George Karlaftis was a fun player to watch, certainly in the Big 12 the last few years. Well, Jordan, I could talk about this all day, but I know you got other things to do. We really appreciate you joining us and really look forward to your pre-draft coverage as we get ready for the combine and pro days, and then certainly the draft itself in April.
No problem. Thanks as always, Adam.
Before we move on, two things I want to mention. We are in the thick of conference play in college basketball, and March will be here before you know it. Get your hoops fixed with Bald Men on Campus, featuring College Game Day's three follically challenged hosts, Jay Billis, LaFonso Ellis, and Seth Greenberg. Listen to Bald Men on Campus every week wherever you listen to podcasts. And watch NBA Today at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on ESPN and the ESPN app, or listen to the show as a podcast. We pivot from the Senior Bowl and the NFL draft lead up to the big item in college football, which continues to be coaching. And while the Michigan situation was resolved last week with Jim Harbaugh returning to Ann Arbor after interviewing with the Minnesota Vikings, another situation emerged late last week at Auburn, which has been looking into the program under Coach Brian Harsin, an investigation from the university side into some allegations of player mistreatment and other things that are going on there. And as we're recording this now, there has not been a resolution yet as to Brian Harsin's status as the Tigers coach. He's only been there for one season, but his future is very much in limbo. And to help me discuss it is my friend and colleague, ESPN senior writer Chris Lowe, who's been all over this story and obviously knows the SEC better than anyone. Chris, as we're recording this right now, what is the latest that you've heard just as far as Brian Harsin and Auburn and that investigation and kind of where things stand? Because there's an SEC coaches meeting on Thursday in Alabama. There's obviously the business of spring football. Auburn has to hire an offensive coordinator. There's a lot to do going forward, but there's still a lot of questions about who's going to be leading that program.
Yeah, Adam, first of all, I would say that I'm not surprised given the dysfunction and complexities of that job over the last, multiple decades. It's Auburn, and you hear that phrase all the time. It's Auburn. You're just never completely surprised at anything that happens. Where we stand is that the program and Brian Harsin has essentially been in purgatory for the last week. And you've got an administrative investigation going on that's been led by one of the president's right-hand men. They're on campus. They have since brought in an outside firm to talk to people, current staffers and coaches. Brian Harsin due in on Wednesday from his vacation. And I don't see any other way that there's not a decision, some type of decision made at some point on Wednesday. As you point out, the head coaches, the SEC head coaches meetings on Thursday. And it's gotten to a point to where I know it's most of us who have followed this story. I think most people, period, looking at it 1,000 feet away, say, well, how in the world can you bring the guy back and him be effective as a recruiter and as head coach at this point. But everybody I talked to, as they have compiled his files, they've talked to former coaches and players, I don't know that they've got enough that they can fire Brian Harsin for cause. So then that leads to the next question. If you're Auburn, if you're President Googe, the outgoing president, do you put it back in the laps of the influential boosters and donors and say, hey, if you guys can come up with $18.3 million, which is what they would owe him if they can't fire him for cause, we'll make this happen. If not, then maybe there is an option and he comes back. As crazy and as surreal as that sounds.
As you've learned about the investigation and some of the things that have been collected, does anything, you know, stand out as unique or particularly alarming here? Or is this, like you said, more about a university that has a track record of turning on its coaches when maybe things aren't going well in other areas? Auburn seemingly had Alabama beaten the Iron Bowl. Tank Bigsby goes out of bounds. If he falls down in bounds, maybe they win that game. They had a good start to recruiting in December. They had a bad finish to recruiting in February. You go through all the coaches, Chris, including Gus Malzahn, who got them to a national championship game, and Gene Chizik, who won a national championship. And you just go on down the list. It feels like to me that every coach since Pat Dye has been undercut to a degree by what's going on behind the scenes, whether it's boosters or administration. So is this story to you more about Brian Harsin or about Auburn University and the way it handles its football coaches?
It's more about Auburn. And it's, you've had competing factions there of influential donors and boosters for a long time. I mean, you go back, as you pointed out, we can pretty much pull out any coach since Coach Dye left, which was 1992. Adam, 1992, Coach Dye coached his last game. So this has been going on for a while. I don't think anybody for one second thinks, had Auburn finished with 9 wins this year, had they not just imploded down the stretch and finished with 9 wins, that we would be here right now. I think at that and the combination of the fact they didn't sign anybody in the second signing day just complicated matters for Brian Harsin and really probably only escalated the situation to get to where we are right now. I think if you set down everybody at Auburn who has some skin in the game, who has some stick, they would tell you what they want more than anything else is someone there who can bring in great football players, the caliber of which that can beat Georgia and Alabama on a consistent basis. That when they go head-to-head with Georgia and the state of Georgia on talented football players, that they win their share of battles. Same in state with Nick Saban in Alabama. That's the primary concern, that they haven't done that. And then you throw in the fact that you had so many coaches leave. You had so many players go in the transfer portal. You clearly had players who were complaining about, fairly or unfairly, Brian Harsin's ability to communicate and relate to some players, especially kids maybe that were a little bit culturally different than him. Players, you've already seen some of the tweets and Instagram posts out there that, you know, he didn't understand or connect with kids from certain areas, those type of things. So I think it's been the culmination of that. But I still go back to what I said a minute ago. If had they won something, they're up, what, 28-3 against Mississippi State. They've got Alabama beat seemingly in the last part of that game. If they win both of those games, win the bowl game, we're not here right now. I don't care what anybody says. We're not here. They don't get to the point where they're interviewing coaches and players and former players about what's going on or what allegedly has gone on in the program with, you know, just the exodus. But that's where we are right now. And again, that's sort of all.
You know, every major program has a set of powerful boosters. How they exert their influence, though, seems to be different place to place. And I know you cover a lot of these programs throughout your career, especially in the SEC. Why do you think the group of Auburn boosters conducts itself maybe differently or seemingly less concerned about the money that it would need to pay a Gus Malzahn or potentially a Brian Harsin or the damage that they would cause when they don't get what they want, which, you know, you could say some of them didn't get what they want when Brian Harsin was hired. What is unique about this group of people that's influencing the Auburn situation?
I think part of it, Adam, is the fact that, you know, you got the two big behemoths there in the state, Auburn and Alabama, both just so prideful about their football programs. And you look at what Alabama has done under Nick Saban, and even going back to, you know, way back under Bear Bryant, that there's that stigma that maybe Auburn is a little brother. And I know that really eats at Auburn people. I think that's part of it. And yet Auburn has had a ton of success. Let's not forget that. You know, you talk to football people, and certainly I've had a chance to get to know a lot of great Auburn people there who've supported that program through thick and thin. And it can be done there. I mean, in the last 12 years, three different times, Auburn has either won a national title, they played for a national title a second time, and they played for an SEC title a third time, in which had they won that game, they would have been playing potentially in the playoff for another national title. So amid all the dysfunction and all this that we're talking about, there's been the support and the tradition and the resources, all the things in place to win at a high level. And I think when you're a part of that, you see that, and you've tasted it, you know, again, going back to Coach Dye's tenure, when they had great football teams, you know, the Bo Jackson years, you know, I think you get people that just sort of want to be involved more than they should be. And then sometimes you have people who fade in and out of power, you know, boosters, and they want more. You know, they want to see this done, or they want this coach, they don't want that coach. And a little bit like what's happened at Texas, quite frankly, you see what's happened at Texas really ever since they pushed Mac Brown out of there. It's been a problem. But anytime you have too many cooks in the kitchen, and that is an issue, as you point out, at a lot of different schools, but it seems to have been magnified over a longer period of time at Auburn.
You know, Brian Harsin was a true outsider, you know, not probably the antithesis of an Auburn guy when he got there. You know, born in Boise, grew up in Boise, played for Boise State at quarterback, and then coached the Boise State program, going 69-19 with four top 25 appearances, won a Fiesta Bowl in his first year. So unquestionably a successful coach, but one that wasn't familiar with the Plains and with the SEC culture a whole lot, although he'd spent some time at Arkansas State as head coach and then as a Texas assistant. What do you think the challenges were for him coming in, and how could he have maybe handled them differently or better to avoid the situation that they're in right now?
Yeah, bringing in Brian, Adam, would probably be akin to you sitting down, eating boiled peanuts, saying you're fixing to do something in the Deep South.
I only do that with you, brother.
I was surprised when they brought Brian in, not because I don't think the guy can coach. I think the guy's a really good football coach, and that's been proven in what he did at Boise State. He is a very much a taskmaster. He's going to do it his way. He is a disciplinarian, committed to doing it a certain way. And not that that didn't work at Auburn. I just think it's more he had not recruited in the SEC. Maybe he didn't have that good old boy persona to him, but neither did Gus Malzahn. Gus Malzahn was not a guy that was out there all the time, you know, sort of hobnobbing with the, you know, the big wigs. Now, Gus did go eat Waffle House after every big win there in downtown Auburn, but everybody's a little bit different. And just because Brian Harsin did it a certain way, was from a different part of the country, didn't mean it wasn't going to work there. Clearly there were problems and there were issues and there were concerns after 1 year, but man, it's hard to assess anybody in any job after 1 year. And I think the fact that the people who didn't want him in, that were not a part of the hiring process, maybe you see this opening after things start to seemingly fall apart and you go get it. But I do think that was a big part of it, that Alan Green, who is the AD, and by the way, I don't think Alan Green has much of any say in what's going on right now. You know, whether or not Brian Harsin is going to make it, who they hire as the next football coach. But he did have a say. Brian Harsin was his hire. And I think that probably rubs some people the wrong way too, because in the past, the donors and boosters there have typically had a big say. I think that's a big part of it. But, you know, fits everything in college football when it comes to a coach. It really is. I mean, you look around the country and some guys fit, some guys don't. I think that's part of what's happened here. But also, in fairness to Brian Harsin, I don't think we haven't had enough of a body of work yet to really say definitively whether or not he's a fit or not at Auburn. Because you know what, Adam? you're always a fit if you win football games.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, we'll have that discussion more with a guy like Brian Kelly going to LSU, having spent, you know, most of his life in the Midwest and in the Northeast, a native of Massachusetts. And LSU has had success with coaches who have really had nothing to do with that state or that school. So it is too soon. I just wonder, though, Chris, no matter how this turns out, the instability at Auburn, you mentioned Allen Green and essentially a potentially powerless or very limited athletic director at this point. You have a coordinator in Derek Mason who left for Oklahoma State and took a pay cut basically to leave Auburn, and they've replaced him with Jeff Schmetting internally. Auburn's still looking for an offensive coordinator after Austin Davis didn't last very long there, had to step down for personal reasons. Young guy there that Brian Harsin had brought in. So if they do choose to move on from Harsin, and I'm with you, I don't know how they fire him for cause. So you're talking about a ton of money on the heels of paying Gus Malzahn a ton of money not to coach Auburn. Where do they go from there? What does a coaching search look like here in late February for a school like Auburn that wants to compete in the SEC? Do they look within the league? Do they look to coaches who have been there before? Certainly Kevin Steele's name had been mentioned the last time around, but when it eventually went to Brian Harsin, what would be the shape of the Auburn coaching search if it does come to that?
Well, I mean, I'll start, you know, if Brian does stay, I mean, remember, he was still trying to look for an offensive coordinator before he went on vacation and couldn't get any answers on what he could pay the offensive coordinator. And supposedly had a salary pool and was said, listen, we're not doing any other contracts. I mean, that's a pretty big red flag right there. So if they do indeed make a change and Brian Harsin is not back, I think the first thing you got to do, Adam, is you got to bring somebody in there who knows the SEC like the back of their hand, who's had some experience in that league, who's recruited in that league successfully, who's won, who's not going to come in and be hesitant. Not, and I'm not saying Brian was hesitant about this, but going head to head, toe to toe with Kirby Smart and Nick Saban on the recruiting trail. You know, David Cutcliffe, the former Duke and head coach, and was at Ole Miss as a head coach, coached for a long time in Tennessee as an assistant, has a saying. He says, you know, if you're going to coach in the SEC, you got to be willing to climb into that octagon at recruiting. And that's just the way it is. You take that for whatever you want, however you want to take it, but someone who can come in there who understands what it takes to recruit, who's got ties and connections throughout the SEC footprint, who can hire a staff, put together a staff that can do that. I think that's probably most important. And you know what? If you set all these people down at Auburn who are making these decisions and you pump them full of truth serum, that would be the number one thing they want, is someone that they feel can go toe-to-toe with Saban and Kirby Smart on the recruiting trail in that radius that sits around Auburn, Alabama, and get as many players to Auburn as Georgia and Alabama, because that's the way you're going to win. I think that's the number one thing. So who are those guys? You mentioned Kevin Steele. I think Kevin Steele had a lot of support the last time. He will again this time. If there indeed a change is made, there'll be some people who won't want it because they'll feel like, you know what, this is just an extension of the old guard again, getting their guy in. Kevin Steele, though, can recruit. Bobby Balvin once told me that he's never been around somebody who's as good a recruiter as Kevin Steele. He knows that program. Lane Kiffin's another guy at Ole Miss. We know he's not afraid to go toe-to-toe with Saban, you know, and poke at him on internet, Twitter, and everything else. Lane did a terrific job at Ole Miss last year, getting 10 wins. Great developer of quarterbacks. Has won in that league. Has done it a couple different places as an assistant to the head coach. I think Hugh Freeze is another guy that would and should get a lot of consideration simply because he's another one that wanted Ole Miss, recruited. Again, quarterbacks have sort of been his thing. He's always had a really good quarterback who's played well. Now, what happened at Ole Miss, the fact that when he left, they were on probation and some of the things that came out there, probably not going to help him. But at some point, Hugh not sort of paid his penalty? You talk about uniting a fan base. I'm not sure there's a fan base that's any more unified right now than the Auburn basketball fan base. Well, guess who did that? Bruce Pearl. Bruce Pearl was fired for unethical conduct at Tennessee. he's back in the league and he's done just a fabulous job in all facets at Auburn. So I think those are the three names. You know, is Eli Drinkwitz a guy? You know, he's in the SEC right now that they would look at. You know, Jeff Grimes is another guy who's coached at Auburn, has Auburn ties. I just have a hard time seeing, again, if there is a change, Adam, Auburn not bringing in somebody that has a lot of experience in the SEC footprint as a coach and a recruiter.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the word that you used, unified, is something that I've talked with some coaches about. If you can't do that and you believe you can't do that, you shouldn't take this job. And you know, believing that you can do it and actually doing it are certainly two separate things. But if you don't have that potential within you, there's no chance against Saban, no chance against Kirby Smart, which Jimbo Fisher's building at Texas A&M, and certainly the track record at LSU. But you bring up that important point with Auburn. Despite all the chaos, we'll get to the C words in a minute there. They win. They can win. They've won a national championship. They've been to that stage, and they can do it in relatively short order with the right approach. So it'll be fascinating to see what happens here on the Plains, and we'll certainly have it all covered for you at ESPN. Yeah, Chris, last thought on Auburn.
Yeah, one thing is Gus Malzahn went to the national championship game, Adam, in his first season.
Yeah.
So what's that tell you? It to sort of punctuate what you just said, it can be done, and it can be done pretty quick.
No doubt. And we'll see. They may have to do a coaching search here very shortly. So we'll see how that all plays out. As we're marching towards the season, it feels like a long way off, but we are doing one of these podcasts every week, and each one is being brought to you by a different letter as we kind of lead up to that end of July or early August period where we'll start ramping up with more podcasts to preview the 2022 season. And Chris, today the letter of the day is C, and there's certainly some terms in college football, chaos being one of them. We just talked about Auburn, cost being another one when we talk about coaches' salaries and buyouts, and Auburn certainly fits that category. But there's also some C teams in the FBS: Cal, Central Michigan, Charlotte, Cincinnati, Clemson, Coastal Carolina, Colorado, and Colorado State. I wanted to focus on two of those here before we wrap up. One was in the college football playoff, and that's Cincinnati, and the other had been in the college football playoff before that every year, and that was Clemson. How do you see these two teams, Chris, responding from the 2021 season? Cincinnati losing a lot of personnel, Clemson not getting to the playoff. They lost both of their coordinators who became head coaches, with Tony Elliott and Brent Venables moving up. How do you see them, I don't know if reloading or rebuilding is the right word, but those are two of the more interesting teams coming up for the 2022 season.
Yeah, I'll start with Cincinnati. Luke Fickell is a ball coach, and everywhere he's been, and you look at, of course, I don't know if he's ever stepped foot outside the state of Ohio. Maybe I think he told me maybe for like a year when he was on the practice squad with the Saints. So that's his domain, and I think without question you're going to see him continue to great to recruit and develop. I think you start talking about developmental programs, and not just because they're a Group of Five team. Now, they're getting ready to go to the Big 12, which I think will only help them here in a couple of years. But in the realm of developmental programs, I think Luke Fickell and his staff have done as good a job as anybody. You know, it's not like they're going out and they're getting just lining up five-star guys. But when a lot of these guys are leaving, and you see two of their DBs leaving this year, they certainly have played like five-star guys, and that's all that matters. Will they be a 12 or 13 win team again next year? Probably not, but I promise you they're not just going to just disappear from the scene. He's too good a coach. He's built too good a program. I mean, you go up there and spend some time, the infrastructure, the way he does things, the way they work. I think they are going to be a good football team, and getting in to the Big 12 will help them. Clemson, probably the most unique challenge Dabo Swinney has faced since he's been there. They've been the epitome of continuity on his staff. He loses both of his coordinators. He's promoted from within in both situations. Wes Goodwin going to defensive coordinator. Wes was a senior analyst. He's never been a coordinator or on-the-field coach before, but certainly a guy that Dabo believes in. And I had a chance to talk to Bruce Arians a few months ago. He worked there under Bruce when Bruce was with the Cardinals. Bruce swears by the guy, how smart he is. And then Brandon Streeter being promoted from quarterbacks coach to replace Tony Elliott, who went to Virginia as head coach. Of course, Venables, the defensive coordinator, going to Oklahoma. That's who Wes is. So I think those are – it will be interesting to see how that all shakes out. I know Dabo was very confident, both of those guys. I still think for Clemson, though, they're going to be outstanding on defense. Their front seven will be as good as anybody in the country. What happens at quarterback? Can they get better play, more consistent play at quarterback? Because if they do that, Adam, in the ACC, I think they're the team to beat. And if they win the ACC championship, you know, they're going to get in the playoff.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think the Clemson situation is so fascinating. I know this is the C day on the podcast, but I'm going to go with a D term, and that's Dabo's double down, because that's what's happening here. Dabo Swinney is doubling down on what's worked for him at Clemson, this approach that, hey, it's different here, and the way that we're going to win is through the guys who have been here rather than going to the outside. Now, he did that for Brent Venables and had incredible success, but going from, you know, the internal promotion has worked. It worked for Dabo Swinney himself, going and being promoted from within the staff, somewhat surprisingly, to head coach and leading them on this historic run. But I think the Brandon Streeter promotion in particular, because he worked with the quarterbacks last year, they didn't get what they wanted necessarily out of DJ Uiagalelei. So is it going to be him? Is it going to be someone else? Can they get back to the type of production at quarterback? It is really going to determine, you know, where they are in the ACC, where they are in the playoff race. And then on a macro level, you know, people are going to wonder, Chris, and fair or unfair, probably isn't fair, if they don't make the playoff, is this window closing? Is the whole Dabo thing, the whole Clemson thing, kind of going out the window if they don't win this year?
Yeah, and, you know, Dabo, when I've talked to Dabo over the years about this, and he said it over and over again, he says, listen, we're a program that's built to last. You know, we were built from the inside out. And if you look at them, that really is, you know, they've had some great quarterbacks, clearly. Trevor Lawrence, you know, playing right now. Deshaun Watson was a great football player in college. But their defensive line is sort of what has carried them. And I think their defensive line, Breezy's healthy this year. I think he will be there in the interior. Their front seven will stack up with anybody in college football this year. You know, maybe Alabama would be another one that would be right up there with them. So I still think that is where they're going to win. They do have to get better play at quarterback. I agree with you. But, you know, I remember a time circa 14, maybe even 15, when Alabama lost to Ole Miss in back-to-back years, people were saying and writing, well, there's cracks in the foundation. Is the dynasty over at Alabama? Well, guess what? It's not over. And I'm not saying that Clemson was where Alabama is, but until this past year, outside of Alabama, no team in college football had been as consistently good as Clemson. Granted, they play in the ACC. They're not in the SEC or the Big Ten. But I still think that probably works in their favor, because if they go 11-1 and win the ACC championship, Adam, they're going to get a shot in the playoff.
No doubt. And it'll be fascinating just to see how that all comes together this offseason, the quarterback competition at Clemson, Cincinnati, also a new quarterback. So a lot to discuss with the C teams. We'll have another letter for you coming your way next week with the ESPN College Football Podcast. But that will do it for today's show. Chris, thank you so much. Thanks to Jordan Reed as well. And we'll be back at it next week. You've been listening to the ESPN College Football Podcast.